And welcome to Community Kitchen. It is a very hot day out there, 29.5, travelling in this morning. And that's at like, you know, 8:30, 9:15. It's incredible, isn't it? I think it's just the humidity. And you keep, someone was just saying just a second ago, when you were a kid, did you have air-conditioned car? No. Did you have an air-conditioned house? No. Maybe we're just getting a little bit soft. And it may well be because, you know, everywhere you go now is air-conditioned, so your body is climatising. But let's talk about climate. Today I thought we'd go a little bit differently. We're going to go into the ocean and have a little bit of a talk to the savages from Bribie, synonymous with seafood, of course. But, you know, you hear people talking about the fact that, you know, I went to buy a tomato, always my little thing I mentioned, and it's going to cost you, you know, an extra couple of dollars. But you don't realise that the effect that the rain has on producing, say, for example, soft things like your lettuce and your zucchinis and tomatoes. And I think sometimes you've got to bite the bullet, support the farmer or support the supplier and go with the trend. As I often say, leave the can of Coke on the shelf and buy some produce or put that money to it. We're all quite happy to go and have six coffees a day, but we're not willing to actually give the money to the farmer. So I thought today what I'd do is take you over to Bribie, and I'm going to be having my wanderings on the third Tuesday of the month. We sometimes have our fantastic traveller from the Jacinta, yeah. Thank you, from Hello Travel, and she does some beautiful food tours around the world, and we're happy to hook up with her when she's here and she's not traipsing somewhere idyllic. So I thought what we'd do is stay a little bit local, have a look around, maybe even visit a few different restaurants, what supplies we have. But right now I want to welcome Natalie from Savages Seafood on Bribie. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning, Annette. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. You know, sometimes we forget to see what's at our back door. And I think it's some, you know, people need to actually know how businesses work. And I was mentioning earlier that the weather has had such an effect, and sometimes prices have to increase and different things are not available. So you're a retail seafood outlet.
Yes, and, we are.
And I think one of the things when you think about Savages, you think of prawns.
Definitely, yeah.
So you're a family of fishermen, and
yes.
So you have the retail and the commercial, and we'll be talking to John, who looks after the commercial side of it, a little bit later. So, Natalie, in your shop, you were saying prawns. What sort of prawns are local to this area?
Tiger prawns, the bay prawns, the small ones that everyone likes to come in and get during the summer months, the banana prawns. We get some local Endeavour prawns. There's a few different species of prawns that are local to the area, most of which we do showcase at our shop because, like many of you know, we do have our own trawler. So that's a big plus for our business because we catch our products basically from this beautiful corner of the globe that we do live in. So we just feel like it's the best of both worlds. You get to catch it from here, you get to eat it from here. So it's, we're really lucky.
You know, also you think about crabs and things like that. I mean, I love crabs. I'm not the best at catching them, but yeah, I think sand crabs are probably more in that Bribie Island Passage. Is that right?
More where we go. We don't catch the crabs ourselves, but we do have a few suppliers that do catch them locally for us. So we, they're local, the sand crabs that we get. Also, when available, we get the local mud crabs, from specific different suppliers, and whenever we can, we love to showcase what we can get from here.
One thing that we talked about yesterday, I was talking about your fish, and I said, you know, I just love the whiting, but you were saying in the summer months you don't get as much, there's not as many fish available.
Well, not just that, it's we don't actually go fishing as such. We don't target the commercial fishing sector during the summer months because it's more of a trawl industry for us, because that's what we have. So our summer months are not spent fishing, they're spent trawling. So that's what we focus on.
So when people are coming to your shop, I mean, you have such a fantastic array of cooked food, plus, of course, the fresh. And you're bringing in some nice, intriguing little things. And what do you think is the most popular? Is it the local prawns?
I definitely think the prawns are the most popular. Plus, over on the cook side, we've got a bit of a selection of what we cook us, what we catch and cook ourselves as well. Like we've got the Moreton Bay bugs that we do on the grill in garlic butter. So it's a bit of a gourmet selection as well. So we do try and showcase what we can catch here and make it look as best as possible. And of course, you can't really argue with the taste because it's, you can't get any fresher. So, and it's just amazing what we have in our area.
Oh, look, I think that this is one thing. Sometimes, like doing the food show on the radio here, I've just met so many people that you, I mean, I never knew that we had a lemongrass farm, that we have a farmer that grows sage and thyme, and we have, you know, mushrooms. And we, apart from all the other things that we do know about pineapples and strawberries and raspberries and all the goodies, but we have just such a fantastic platter of foods in our region.
I definitely agree with you, Annette. I don't think you can get much better of an array of a variety, of course, of local product. It's, you know, anywhere from fruits and vegetables to meats and seafood. I think we're, like I said before, we're just extremely lucky to live where we are. So why not support what we've got here in our local area?
Tell me about oysters. Now,
Yep.
Is that something that we, I mean, once upon a time, I know that the oysters that we have are quite small in this area. Is it something that you sell?
We do definitely sell them. Yeah, we get them flown up from either Sydney, the Pacific oysters, or we've also gotten them in from Coffin Bay as well, just depending on the season and what's available. I think it's sort of the weather is a bit of an issue here, whereas the climates they grow in better are the cooler climates, so that's sort of where you get the best ones from. But of course, we like to have the best in. So if it was locally possible, we definitely would. But then again, it's definitely still Australian and definitely still delicious.
You know, it amazed me. I did emceeing of a show over at Sandstone Point, and they were showcasing all the different foods from the region. And I did a little bit of research, and I just loved this article about this woman many, many, many years ago, before the bridge, before anything was happening on Bribie, and she had a fish plant. And so she would get the mackerel and, you know, catch the fish here and then take it across to, I think it was Sandgate or that area, and she had a fish canning business. So when you think about it, Bribie's quite an interesting little place. It's got quite a history, hasn't it?
Definitely, yeah. Back in the early days of Bribie, it started off as a fish canning place of business. So, yeah, I think it, hopefully we can continue on that legacy of beautiful seafood in this area.
Now, tell me one thing. People often talk about peeling the prawns. Now, if I'm doing, I love green prawns. So if I'm, you know, cooking with a green prawn, I always take the head off first. You give this sort of squeeze down the body and sort of pull the cap off. Is there a trick?
Well, we do peel a lot of prawns here, yeah. Most of us can get it off in either two or three goes. So you twist the head, then grab the four legs,
yes,
between the thumb and forefinger and peel it around and then pinch and pull the tail. So, yeah, there's three goes.
And what about cleaning that prawn?
All you got to do is basically just pinch the top part of it and peel it back, and you're going to get that sand line out of it as well, the bit that some people don't like. But, again, some people like that bit. And also, some people actually like the heads and the goodness inside the head. So, yeah, don't discriminate.
Well, I know that to make a great stock, of course, I mean, I watch cooking shows, I love them, but they always say to keep those heads and the skins cook them off a little bit and actually start to create the stock, because you get a really good basis for a lot of beautiful soups and things like that.
Definitely.
And with the fish heads and goodies. Now, with your shop there, you sort of work a very full week. I notice it's sort of like 7 days a week from 10 or something till 7:30.
Correct.
So they're long hours, and I think this is a dedication that you have. When you've got a family business, and I know that from experience, that you've really got to put those hours in, haven't you?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, we haven't been here for over 15 years for no reason. We do have a lot of loyal staff, which we just adore. We couldn't do it without our staff. We have about 30, give or take, and a lot of them are very long term. Some are, you know, between 5 and 10 years. Most of them are. So yeah, it's good to have a good team of people behind you, definitely.
So now I'm going to put you on the spot and say, if you were to cook the perfect seafood meal, what would your favourite be, and how would you do it?
Well, good question. Actually, my favourite menu item that we have at the moment is our salmon kebab. So we cube up pieces of salmon along with slices of capsicum, grill it on our hot plate with a soy sesame ginger sauce and steam it. It's amazing. And I'd probably couple that with a deep fried soft shell crab.
Oh my goodness, how nice is that?
That's usually what I have if I'm here for lunch or dinner. If I have time to eat, I'll usually cook myself that.
I was in Chinatown one day and I love to get the Chinese duck, and I went to this different distributor and I was watching some people buy some soft shell crabs, and I had to ask, you know, how are you going to cook those? And she said, all we ever do is just dust them off with a little bit of corn flour. Mm-hmm. And then quickly fry them and then toss them with a chili and ginger and all those sort of goodies. And I thought, that's how you eat these lovely fresh flavours. Just
Definitely.
Make a big difference. Now, when it comes to cooking a piece of fish on your griddle or in your pan, are you cooking in butter or are you cooking oil?
The oil that we use for deep frying is a premium quality oil that we change on a very regular basis. So we get the premium breadcrumbs. We also make our batter from scratch. So everything that goes in there is completely fresh and clean and of premium quality for the deep fry side of things. On our grill, for the health conscious or someone who just wants something a bit different, it's a commercial hot plate. So we just grill it on top of that. We use lids if we need to steam the item. So just depending on the flavour that you choose, we have a few different flavours you can choose for our grilled items. So they're each prepared a little bit differently, all sort of tried and tested and perfected by my mother-in-law, Jumei Savage. She's the queen of the cooking here. So.
Isn't that, and that's the whole thing, isn't it? Like, for the amateur at home cooking some fish, you know, you see the recipes and they say to get that crispy skin, you've really got to put that fish onto the pan and get some really good heat on there. But a lot of the times people are hesitant to do that. And, of course, it depends on the type of pan. You're saying you've got a commercial grill plate. That makes a big difference when you're cooking to the average, you know, family kitchen where you've probably got a different type of heat and a different type of pan. But one of the things that I guess having that good product, number one, to start with, fresh is going to make a big difference.
Exactly. So does a lot of practice. And we've been here for more than 15 years and we've done it time and time again. So practice makes perfect.
I think that's good. Now, calamari, that's another thing that people find can be a tricky thing. I mean, I remember reading this Italian recipe that what they used to do years ago is they'd get the calamari, they'd throw it in the cement mixer, put a couple of rocks in there and let it go. And that is a true thing that I read in this book. And that softened it up over time, but, you know, people have changed that. Some like to actually boil the calamari and then they'll actually chop it up. Give us a few hints. If I were to go to the shop...
Yeah, I think it all depends on the way you cook it as well. I find it cooks a lot better and even more even in a deep fryer rather than shallow frying. But you can also grill it, which is what we do. And just so long as you're moving it around regularly, don't let it sit in one spot for too long. Just toss it around with either tongs or a spatula. Let it cook evenly and not for very long either. As soon as it changes colour from a little bit transparent to white, then it's cooked.
Yeah. And I think that's always the fear, isn't it? You think that it's not quite cooked. And it's a little bit like scallops. I always have a bit of a hard time getting that perfect scallop because, once again, you've got to sear that off and maybe you should tell us how to cook that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it just depends on how you like it. Either, you know, a lot of people like it rare, medium rare, with the scallops. So I think it's just a matter of practice, you know, just get in there and don't be scared of it. Don't be afraid of seafood and how to cook it. It's beautiful. It's going to be delicious either way. So, you just got to find out the way you like it.
That's fantastic. Thanks for joining us, Natalie. Enjoy your day. The sun's shining.
And
we're going to be talking to John a little bit later, John Savage, and we're going to be talking commercial fishing. But thank you for joining us on Community Kitchen.
Thank you, Annette.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
We've been talking to Natalie. And that's one thing, isn't it? I mean, I love seafood. I think seafood's a beautiful thing. But learning those little tricks and how to cook it is just, I think, the one thing. And as she says, it's a bit of practice. But interesting, I saw this great article the other day and talking about the water. And this particular guy, climate farmer, Bren Smith, championing sea greens as a nutritious food. And kelp, apparently, is the new kale. So get out there, have a look. If you remember last year, we talked to one of the scientists from Sunny Coast Uni who was working on some different seaweeds on kelp at Bribie Island, and he was talking about the fact that probably in the future you'll see that there'll be a particular pasta that will actually just be seaweed. So, you know, there's some great stuff happening. But I think it's quite interesting to think that kelp is now the new kale. And the interesting thing about it was we often ask, where on earth did kale come from? Because it was nowhere. Then all of a sudden it hit the fashion of foods, and it stayed with us for that time. So very interesting how these food trends. So this one little recipe I did see, which I thought was quite nice, that they used the mung bean vermicelli and used that with seafood threads or any type of dried seafood, and did a dressing along the lines of what Natalie was talking about before. And it was a sesame oil, mirin, rice wine vinegar, tamari and brown sugar. And, of course, that's going to give you that beautiful Asian. So if you imagine that with some seafood threads, some mung bean vermicelli, which takes 2 seconds, bit of chili, maybe some bean sprouts, and then some lovely seafood with that, so maybe nice even scallops, seared scallops. Beautiful way to actually enjoy, to have that little bit of a different seafood platter on your kitchen table. We'll go to a song, and then we're going to come along and we're going to be talking a little bit about the different weather effects that we've been noticing. You've got to have noticed that there's such a big trend for plant-based foods, replacing your proteins. And it's really interesting, some of the substitutes that you're finding and reading about. I know that when I did a cooking event up at Wood 40 a couple of years ago, we changed. We made used the juice from a can of chickpeas to create the, you know, the eggs, and, you know, there's whole lots of stuff out there, but this really, really did blow my mind. Using watermelon roasted is actually looking like a
tuna.
Yeah, a raw tuna copycat. So evidently what you do, you preheat your oven to 180 degrees and you cut your watermelon into sushi shapes. And so you place the watermelon blocks in this. I mean, sorry, you don't do it into the little thin pieces. You do sort of cut 2 10 by 2.5 centimetre blocks from the fruit without the skin, and add the 2 tablespoons of sunflower oil into an oven-proof dish and place the watermelon blocks in this and drizzle with a little bit of the oil and bake for 20 minutes. Remove it from the oven to turn the watermelon over before returning it to bake for another 10 minutes and watching to make sure it doesn't brown. So isn't it incredible how people discover this stuff? So meanwhile, you're making, you know, usual suspects, the tamari, mirin, sesame oil and rice vinegar in a small bowl. And when the watermelon has cooled slightly, pour the marinade over the top and cover with foil and sit in it for another 20 minutes before placing in the fridge for about an hour. Now, this particular Amanda Logan has actually given this recipe in a mag that I was reading the other day. And then you do your rice, you know, as you regularly do for sushi rice, and then you're cutting to assemble. You form a handful of the sushi rice, of course, into your 5 centimetre log and repeat with the remaining rice. Take the marinated watermelon and slice it on angle to mimic tuna sushi before laying it over the rice, and then top with your pickled ginger and served. I'm looking at a picture of this, of course, and it is looking exactly like watermelon. So who on earth thought about that? How did someone decide one day that I love sushi, tuna sushi or whatever, so much that I have to duplicate it? And it is amazing. We're going to see some really, really interesting recipes, because you know, just saying to Rosemary before listening to the news on the way in, the weather has such an effect on the sorghum, the cotton, the wheat and the rice. Production is down so much that we're going to start to see some interesting things happening. And I noticed in one of the cooking books the other day I was reading, starting to use millet now as a bit of a base, replacing things like rice and things like and other ingredients like that. So we're going to start to see some very interesting recipes come about, not only because of the weather, but because of the influence of the vegan and plant-based diets that we're having. Interesting, though, I thought it was funny that sugar always gets me a little bit, because sugar is a natural product, and if you're using a natural form of sugar and you're replacing with a commercially produced synthetic sugar, wouldn't it be better to go back to what was the original? So that always has a little bit of a contrary. If you're one of those people out there who disagrees, give me a buzz. Love to talk about it on the show, because this is how we learn and we change our different eating patterns. I know that maybe I'm probably classed as more traditional in the fact that I do like my proteins and I do like my veggies, and I will try things, and I'm always trying different recipes. But some of these plant-based and different vegans, they're really doing my mind in a little bit, because they're so creative. They're just amazing. I mean, we saw the first lot of jackfruit, which become the replacement for the burger, because the texture is so similar to meat. And now I notice in the supermarket, and have a little look, give yourself 5 minutes to go and have a look at some of these different replacements, because people who are choosing to do that are actually still wanting to have, say, a burger for dinner. If they've gone plant-based and the family's having other, then you can actually do that by using these different substitutes. But who originally worked that out in the first place? I just think that is quite incredible. I know there's people who are duplicating eggs by using different products. There's so many things out there, and I think it's great. I buy a couple of mags to, you know, just to read, and there's different bacons out now. Of course, they've been around for a long time, but there's a company that has a particular bacon that's a maple syrup liquid smoke, because I think I would always miss that. I always say I could be a vegetarian, but I'd have to have meat and steak and bacon. And then, of course, you've got so many different types of grains and oils and drizzles and things that people are using. There's a lot of coconut being used. Tahini's come back into fashion. I know back in the 70s everything had tahini in it, and now it's starting to come forth. We've got quite a flavour of Middle Eastern flavours coming through the food. We talked about that last week, and I've since found so many different recipes. Like, there's one particular one I read the other day, which is a borgel salad with pomegranate molasses, roasted pumpkin and pistachios. That's my sort of food that I really like. And, you know, these are all different changes that we took from the tabbouleh that we had a couple of weeks ago, and I've put these recipes up on the website, and I'll always do that with everything we talk about. They'll be up probably tomorrow. I'll put them on their listing so you can go and have a little look. But it's nice to just change that, and sometimes not having that ingredient in your pantry does create that change in the recipe. So I think that's the fun of cooking. But do yourself a favour, have a little look. I think there's a lot of different allergies that people have that have made us actually think a little bit outside the square. I know that I have friends who have got incredible intolerances, and that really does change it. But I do notice that even a lot of the sweet things now, we're using a lot of hemp seeds. We're going back to using the flax seeds, which was something that used to be used in a lot of different cookings and that. So I think that this is a little revival for people who are going to have a total vegan diet. They really have to think outside the square to give the flavours. And I think finding these recipes really does bring it forward and give you some interesting goodies to put on your family table. So I think it's worthwhile having a little look and just seeing what's out there. But we're going to go to a song, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to John Savage about commercial fishing. Thanks, Rosemary, and welcome back to Community Kitchen. We're talking seafood today. We've talked retail, and now we're going to head out to the ocean with John Savage. Good morning, John.
How are you going?
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. John, you know, we've over the last few months on the air and the news and whatever, we're all talking about the effects of the rain, how it affects the tomatoes and the lettuce. But what does it do to the ocean?
With the rain, it sort of boosts up the catches of the seafood, prawns, fish and all that sort of stuff. We've been pretty quiet for the last 5 or 6 years with the drought. We've been affected really bad with that. But with all this rain that we've got now in the next probably 6 months to 12 months, it should be a good season in the prawns, it should be a good season in the fish. There should be abundance of everything. But the only thing that we face in saying that is all the closures that we've endured in the last 5 to 10 years. So all the areas that we used to go and catch all this product in, now it's closed to me. So there's going to be abundance of seafood out there, but to access it is near on impossible. So it's going to be a bit tough.
And, you know, isn't it incredible that someone was saying one day, they was talking about fishing, and they said, oh, if you've got a drought in the land, you're going to get a drought in the sea. So that, what sort of effect does that have on you? When you say you've had 4 to 5 years of drought, what happens to the fish?
They just don't come out of the rivers and the creeks. And most rivers and creeks are closed to us, so we can't access it anyway. But when you get the floods, it pushes them out into the bay. As fresh water floats on top of salt water, the fish go into deeper water, so they go out in the bay to find deeper water, and they'll sit out there till the rivers and that sort of get back to the saltiness, and then that opportunity happens, it gives us a chance to sort of capitalise on that.
So with all this, I notice that all the creeks at the moment, there's so much, you know, they're dirty. Does that have an effect on the ocean, or does that disperse quite quickly?
Disperses really quickly. Within a day or two, you'll start seeing a change again. But just all the rubbish and that comes off the land, it goes through the ocean, ends up out in the bay, down through the rivers, ends up out in the bay. And yeah, it takes time for that to sort of come good, but it does make the fishing for everybody a lot better, much better.
So, John, just, and let's not get political, but tell me about these closures.
I've endured a lot of yellow zone closures and green zone closures. Yellow zones are recreational only.
Yep.
I'm allowed to access recreational only areas, but with a certain size net and a certain length of net. But I'm not allowed to take brim whiting and flathead, which is mainly my prime target of seafood, in the yellow zone. So the only fish I can target in yellow zones, which is where I live in Broadby Island, is 80% of the area that, you know, I actually fish in now. I can't take any of that species of fish, so I actually take all the rubbish fish and put that through the markets, like long tom, silver bitties, back to valley, all that sort of stuff. So all the prime fish, the money fish, which I call it, I can't access it at all. That's what the government does. They just put in a new map of closures and net fishing. There's a 40-ton allocation, that's a TAC, a total allowable catch for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I used to net around about 5 to 10 ton a year in Moreton Bay, right in front of me. They've just allocated that to the line fishery, so I've lost all of that. That's all government decisions. They just look at things and they think they know what they're doing. It's good for the fishery, but at the end of the day, it's just killing people like me. I'm a third-generation fisherman, and my sons are trying to survive in it, and we've invested in trawlers and other types of fishing to sort of stay in the industry. But the government seems to know, think they know better, some unknown reason. But everything they come up with is just not good.
I remember years ago, I was a kid from out the Wandoan area, and our local sales were always what brought people to town, the shopping, everything happened, you know, on that particular Tuesday, and it was a really big event. And I remember, you know, my dad saying at one stage he wanted to get a little yard actually organised for his little abattoir there, and he had to have a particular government ruling. And then, of course, you weren't allowed to have ship cattle unless they'd have this approval. And, you know, you just saw over time little towns where the sale yards just disappeared, and it stopped that economy. So sometimes there's not logic in these decisions.
Absolutely not. The same thing's happening in the fishing industry. I can't see anybody or any younger generation wanting to take this job on because the government is actually, I'm not a political person, but I've just seen what's happened over the last 40 years in the fishing industry, and I've just seen a spiral downhill. My license, once upon a time, was worth quite a good amount of money. Today, it's virtually non-saleable. And that's my super. It's my retirement. It was. It's not now because it's at the moment I'm struggling with the fees. The fees have gone up and the cost of the licence have gone down. So, and we, as you know, we've got a seafood business on Bribey, and when I first started fishing with the family and stuff like that, we used to sell probably 80 to 90% of seafood in the shop was locally caught. Today it's probably a total turnaround. I don't know, maybe 20% of it's local, and that'd be, you know, maybe exaggerating.
And that'd be generous. So tell me this then.
Probably would be like all the garfish and all the brim and the whiting and the flathead and all that stuff, and mullet even, you know, we have a good mullet season here. But that's only a part of the season. It's like the mullet season might run for like 2 months. Mm. So all the local people get a bit of a, you know, a bonus. They get cheap seafood for about 2 months out of the sea mullet season. They don't get that anymore out of the other fish because it's too hard to access. So the price has just gone skyrocketed.
So also the thing with the fish and everything, it's so regulated for the, even for me, for someone who's the worst fisherman in the whole world, but even for me I have to be regulated. But you're talking about the fact that your whole business is regulated, and I thought that we were trying to stop imported seafood. You know, doesn't this, having all this restriction, just increase the fact that, like you were saying, your license fees are going up and at the same time your value of your business is coming down, you've got lots of regulation. Does that just make it that we're going to be importing fish from overseas and forget about the local trade?
Well, to me, it just looks like the government just don't want us to be here. Well, I get no support whatsoever from our government. Never have. Never. I used to fish the Thomastone Passage. I was one of the fishermen that it was closed down to, and I don't know how many years ago that was, maybe 30 years ago, maybe, and that was all political. It was nothing to do with the resource or whatsoever. All these decisions have nothing to do with the resource. There's an abundance of fish out here. Mm. I can take anybody any time, and the bottom moves with brim, whiting, flathead. It just literally moves. And where those fish are, there's no line fishermen there targeting that species. And what happens, it's just a dead set waste of the resource. And in saying that as well, they've just got all these VMSs put on us, their vessel monitoring system. We have to pay, I think it's about $40 a month per each one. We have three licences in the family, plus two trawlers. And, you know, you multiply that, the net licence, I think, at $40 a month per one, and the trawlers are about $100 and something a month. So we throw all that on top of everything. They know exactly where we are, what we're doing, everything, the whole lot. And I got the other day, talking about a guy, you know, he was out there and his VMS wasn't working, and just the fine on that alone was $2,800.
What?
Just because his vessel, VMS wasn't working on the boat. And you have to go home. You can't negotiate and say, look, I'm going to stay out here and I'll fix up when I come in. You have to leave the operation, head straight back to the shore. And that's what we have to do. You know, you get people out in the society have ankle bracelets. They don't have to pay for them. They have them free. You know what I mean? And I literally have to pay for it.
For your ankle bracelet.
It's crazy.
And you haven't committed a sin. Go back to
absolutely not.
Go back to the fact that you were saying that the bottom of the ocean is swimming. How quickly does it replenish? Like, you know, you harvest a crop, you see that you plough it, you plant it, and it regrows. When you're actually harvesting, what's the supply, like with a whiting, for example? What's the cycle of the whiting? How long does it take for a whiting to be from a baby to a big fish?
About 2 years.
Okay.
To what I gather, to what I've seen over the years, just what my knowledge.
Yep.
And you have everything seasonal. So your whiting sort of run August, September, October. You get them all year round, but that's when they row up and that's when they travel. Every tide change, it replaces fish. Fish move. They don't stay in one spot. But the trouble is with the area that we have out here, they go from one yellow zone to another yellow zone. They come from a green zone to a yellow zone to a yellow zone. And for me to access the areas where I can sort of get to catch these fish, I have to travel now instead of just using 3, 4, 5, 10 litres of fuel and just zip out the front here and catch all the fish I needed. I now have to, invest in a 7-metre boat, a 250 horsepower motor, I've got to run from here over to Mortlong, which is about an hour and a half from my boat. Mm. That's weather permitted, and if it's too windy for, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I got 2 days to make my money, and some days I can't even get over there because of the weather. The whole bay's closed 2 days a week for recreational fishers. It's just a closure that's been in place for a long time.
Mm.
So everything I've got to do is in that 5 days or that 5 day period, and weather permitted, and there, it's just not accessible as like it used to be.
I think the thing that concerns me about that is, once again, coming back to the fact that we had that big scare just recently with the prawns and the contamination, but we're all talking about the fact that we're supposed to be having local and seasonal and regional. And you'd think that the consideration for the ruling would allow for that, so that you can actually get back to farming the oceans as we do our land. I mean, looking at the water restrictions that our guys are going to face out west very shortly, even though we've got flooding at the moment, it's only a very tiny little scope that's going to last for. But you sort of start to see that there has to be a realistic backtracking to how things used to be, the traditional way of farming, whether it be on the land or in the ocean, because a lot of these things are just not working. And I think food sustainability is probably one of the biggest worries in the next years.
I agree. I think we have a lot of sustainable fishing methods. Like, we have mesh sizes that control the size of fish.
Mm.
We have net lengths, which, you know, you're not going to over catch more than what you can handle type thing.
Yep.
We have a lot of common sense in the fishery from fishermen like me. I've been doing it for over 45 years. With these yellow zones, if they just, I don't know, they've just got to remove yellow zones. If yellow zones removed out of Moreton Bay, or we could use different net sizes in yellow zones to target certain species of fish, that will work. It would increase my shop sales to the local public. Lots, they'll get more accessible to locally caught fish, and it'll just go right around, you know. Like, but the yellow zones to me are probably the worst thing that the government's ever done. It's like, as you say, farmers, you own your own block of land, and you get told how many trees you can cut down. It's the same deal. Like, you know, the yellow zones, I get told what fish I can and can't keep. And all the fish that I can't keep is all the money fish. It's a fish that people want to buy to eat.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So,
and I guess the more that you're supplying, the more that the price comes down, because you've got abundance of it, so therefore we actually benefit by that at the same time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. John,
absolutely.
Thanks for joining us this morning, because it's one of those things that you don't always hear the ins and outs of farming. And I think that over the next few months I'm going to be pulling in a few different types of supplies, whether it be cattle or dairy or whatever, because I think that we need to be enlightened and maybe not whinge when that price of that tomato goes up by 1 cent a kilo.
That's right.
Thanks, John.
I agree. No worries. You have a good day, eh?
And you too. And
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure talking. We've had the savages on this morning. From one side,
no worries.
We've got the Natalie from retail, and, of course, we've just been talking to John from the commercial. And it really is food for thought. I think that sometimes we need to really just open our minds a little bit and have a look at these different ventures. And no doubt when we talk to some different veggie growers, commercial, you're going to find that the water's affected them. But, you know, it's interesting that John was saying the drought has had a real effect on them for the last 4 to 5 years, and it's something that you don't always put any thought to. We just imagine that we're just going to be getting our seafood and it just comes. But I hadn't realised that 80% of our fishing area in the bay there is yellow zone. So, pardon me, excuse me, but Rosemary's coronavirus. But, you know, sustainable methods and that are really very important for 45 years experience. Maybe these are the sort of people that we should be bringing in as the advisors. I often think that with some of our farmers. I read different articles and you get some of that real logical, where you see farmers who have been having that burn and that slashing for years and composting and you know, doing some really good things, yet they're left by the wayside. So let's all support them, folks, and let's look for the local. I think that that's one thing that, you know, okay, sometimes we can get it cheaper elsewhere, but I think that it's worth that extra cent or two. Of course, as I said earlier, I'm going to be putting up some different recipes. I'm going to put that watermelon sushi up. I thought that was quite interesting. I wish I could actually give you the picture, because it is just exactly the same as a tuna.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
You would not know.
No. Rosemary's even going to do that this week, I think, to bake some watermelon and make some of that tuna. Mm. But I think we're going to see a lot of really cool, groovy little things come out of it. A lot of people are going, you know, no meat for one day. Your choice, folks. You can eat however you like. But I just think it's nice that we can actually have a look and just expand our mind a little bit and enjoy what we have out there. That's it for me. Next week, of course, we're talking herbs with Sarah Heath from Narangba. She has so much great knowledge, and it was the only thing you've heard last night. I did some roast lamb, and I just went and got abundant amount of mint leaves and just tossed them through some broccolini and some peas and a little bit of olive oil and so much mint, and it was just beautiful. You forget sometimes something as simple as that can just really lift that flavour and make those little peas and broccolini really shine. So until next week, have a great week, and I'll be here with Community Kitchen on Tuesday.